Oh, I want you to know, it is torture for me to be with you today. I mean that sincerely. You see, I know this day that you celebrate, this day you celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. And that makes this a particularly painful day for me. You see, I was the one chiefly responsible to see that he was executed. And so to come here today and to see you celebrating, it's like rubbing salt into the wounds. But that's what every day is like now. I made my choice and I now live every day with the torture of the choice that I made. I was given a reprieve to come from hell itself to tell you my story. Perhaps it might be of some help to someone, I was told. But I know that even as I tell you that I was responsible for Jesus' execution, that you've already decided that I'm the villain in the story. I mean, because you're here, you're celebrating Jesus' resurrection, he's the hero. And if he's the hero, there must be a villain. And I must be he. If that's what you want, you can have it. But I want you to know, I'm here to tell you that it's not that simple. It's easy to believe there are good people in the world and there are bad people in the world. Sometimes you think the bad people, well, they speak with a snarl and they wear black. I suppose that's a strike against me. But it's in the real world, it's never that easy. You can't tell simply by looking who is the good person or who is the bad. There are many people, perhaps some of you, who live in deception much of your life. I know. I did as well. You know it from just reading your history books that telling the hero and the villain is never as easy as it might seem. Think about your history. I know little about it, but what I know is that most of your heroes salute your American flag. But not everyone sees the good guys and the bad guys the same. Your neighbors, how do you say it, across the pond, the people in England, even they don't always see things the way you do. They have a man in their history books, and he was a great patriot. He served in their army. I suppose some would call him a hero. But you call him a scoundrel. I believe his name is Benedict Arnold. To you, he's a traitor. To them, he's a patriot. And whether he's good or bad probably depends on which side of your Atlantic Ocean you find yourself. No, it's not always that easy to tell who is good and who is bad. So don't be too quick to judge me. But I am not here to defend my innocence. I'm not here to talk about me primarily. I'm here to tell my story so that you can learn something about you. It's easy to think you know who the good person, who the bad person is, but I want to point you in a different direction this morning. See, my name is Caiaphas. I was the high priest in Israel for 18 years. It was not an easy job being high priest in Israel back then, in what you call your first century. Oh, you may know from reading the Hebrew scriptures that the high priest was responsible for helping people know God and being kind of an intermediary between God and the people. But I assure you, my job was even more complicated than that. Because you see, in my day, in the first century, we were not an independent people. We had not lived as an independent nation for some 400 years, but we were occupied. We were under the thumbprint of Rome. And because of that, I had a kind of a liaison role as the high priest between the people of Israel and the government of Rome. And so I had the challenge not only to be the religious leader of a sometime obstinate people, but I was also the person who had to satisfy Rome and the Roman interests. So it wasn't easy. In fact, as high priest, you may not realize this, but I was appointed to be high priest by Valerius Gratus, the Roman procurator before your Pontius Pilate. I wasn't appointed by the Jews, but by the Romans. So it was a challenge to live as a high priest, to satisfy the demands of the people and the demands of the government. But that wasn't all. What made my job even harder was the fact that my family, a family of priests, I came from a long line of Sadducees, a long line of priests, and their influence influenced me as well. My father-in-law was a man by the name of Annas. Annas was high priest before me, and he continued to exert his influence in the priesthood before me and after me. If you read your New Testament, the gospel you call Luke, Luke says that there was a high priest in Israel, Caiaphas and Annas. A high priest, Caiaphas and Annas. Oh, it irks me. I was the high priest. Annas was my father-in-law. Why he got billing was because no matter what I did, he was always behind the scenes pulling the strings. And so I had to juggle the Roman, the Jewish people, the Roman people, and Annas, and these things made my life, I thought, a hell. I know better now. But as I sought to live with these tensions, this fellow you came called Jesus came on the scene. In fact, before him was a man by the name of John the Baptist. Perhaps you know it because I saw your sign says something about Baptist out front. Anyway, he was a prophet, you may know. And he started to turn the people against us. He preached and he said that they needed to repent. And well, what that meant was they needed to turn from the things we were teaching them. And the amazing thing was that so many people did. And as John the Baptist gained followers, we realized that he was a threat. I must tell you that when Herod decided that he'd had enough of John the Baptist, and he called for his head on a platter, literally, I was quite relieved. Because I thought, this man is a troublemaker, and it's better for me, it's better for my people, if he just shuts up. And Herod handled it quite well, in my opinion. And yet, no sooner had John left the scene than this fellow Jesus had a following himself. He too was a preacher, but people said that he did miracles. And people followed him to hear what he had to say, to see what he would do. And it seemed like in no time, all of a sudden, he had a following. And I know you know him. You come here today because of him. But you don't know the Jesus that I know. You believe in this Jesus who is love, Jesus who is grace, Jesus who is kind, who is gentle. That's not the Jesus that I knew. No, Jesus was difficult. Jesus seemed to undermine us at every turn. Let me give you an example. We, as priests, sought to make it easier for people to worship. That was part of our job. So we helped in the religious system to provide sacrifices for them to use in the temple. We arranged for them to sell sacrifices, lambs and goats, a ram perhaps, a bull. And we had that inside the temple in the court of the Gentiles. And there were people who would come. This was particularly helpful for the pilgrims who would come at Passover, because they would come, and they would come from all over the world. And nobody could bring a ram or an oxen or a sheep. It was too far. So they needed to come and to buy them, and they could buy them there at the temple. We provided that for them. But of course, if you wanted to buy a ram, you wanted to buy a lamb, you had to have money. And the temple had its own money, so people would come with their drachmas or whatever their currency was, and they would exchange it in our temple, and they would buy these animals so they could sacrifice. It was a service that we did for these people. And yet Jesus, one day, stormed into the temple as if he owned it. And he started turning over the tables of the money changers. He started saying, "You've made my house, my father's house, a den of thieves." You know, he was speaking of the money changers, I want to believe, but we had made this arrangement. He was talking about us as well. Somehow, we had allowed this place to be a den of thieves. He was always saying things like that. If you listened to what Jesus had to say, you would not think of him as this meek and mild Savior of yours. He could be in your face. He could be downright ugly. He said to us, to our faces, that we were hypocrites, that we were whitewashed tombs, that we were full of dead men's bones. We were greedy. We were wicked. That was on his good day. Now, this Jesus that I knew was not this passive Jesus that you talk about so often. He was a problem. He was someone who was destined to ruin things for us and for our people. We tried as much as we could to be reasonable with him. When there were opportunities, we would try to discuss things with him, to come to some understanding. There were different ones of our leaders that met with him and talked to him and tried to help him see the error of his ways, but he was undeterred. It was obvious we had to silence him somehow. The question was, how could we do it? And the problem was, with every passing day, his numbers, his followers, those who considered him not just to be a great teacher, but to be the Messiah himself, those numbers increased. And with their numbers came the pressure on us, on me, Caiaphas, the high priest. Something had to be done. Well, it all came to a head one day after a funeral, of all things. Now, this will give you an insight into this man. He had a good friend. That friend's name was Lazarus. When that friend died, Jesus didn't go to his funeral. He showed up 3 days after the funeral. What kind of friend is that? You think Jesus is always there for you? Well, he wasn't there for Lazarus. All I can tell you is that the rumors that came from Bethany were something amazing that happened. There were people who said that when Jesus showed up, he stood at the tomb of Lazarus and had them remove the stone in front of the tomb, and he said, "Lazarus, come forth." And Lazarus, they say, rose from the dead. Can you believe that some people would believe that? Well, I guess you could. But I, as a Sadducee, I couldn't believe it. I mean, I don't believe in fairy tales. I don't believe in resurrections. I don't know what happened there in Bethany, but those people were deceived, and I wasn't going to be tricked with them, and I wasn't going to let them to influence our nation. The problem was, after this incident, more and more people kept going to Jesus. One day, the members of the Sanhedrin came to me. They said, "What are we going to do? What are we going to do? He keeps working miracles, and people believe in him. If we let this go on and on, everyone's going to turn to him. And then the Romans are going to take away our temple, destroy our temple, and we'll be ruined." There are some times when a leader just has to stand up and lead. And so I gently said to the members of the Sanhedrin, "Don't you know anything? Don't you get it? There's something we can do. It is better for the people that one man die than that the whole nation should perish." And that's when we decided together that Jesus had to die. This is a question not then of if, but when. And how? I mean, it had to be some sort of judicial death. We couldn't murder him. So we thought, well, this man is always making all these statements. We will accuse him of blasphemy, and we will try him, and we will convict him, and then sentence him to death. Seems simple enough. But we had to figure out when we would do it, how we would do it. And he was only over in Bethany, which is not very far from Jerusalem. And so we decided that on Passover, when he came into Jerusalem, that would be the time. That's when we would arrest him. But we didn't realize that he would have such a following. All these people who believed in him, they flocked to Jerusalem, and they were lining the road, and they were singing Hosanna, and they were throwing down palm branches, and they believed that Jesus was the Messiah. And we realized there was no way we could arrest Jesus there. They would kill us. And so we had to come up with another plan. I called a meeting in my house of the Sanhedrin. They met with me on the city wall where I lived. And as we talked about it, we said, this is not going to work. We can't arrest him during Passover. If we do that, it'll be a riot. We can't afford to do that. We'll have to come up with another plan. To my amazement, the plan presented itself. For one of Jesus' followers came to us. Not just a follower, one of his disciples. He was a man who had seen through Jesus, saw what he was really about, and was disillusioned by him, as I felt everyone should be. And this disciple, Judas, gave us an option. He said that Jesus regularly would go, when he was in Jerusalem, to a garden called Gethsemane outside of Jerusalem, and he would pray alone. Judas said, that's where you can get it. And Judas said, I will turn him over to you for a small fee. And so the plan was set. We showed up with guards, and there he was. We had him arrested, and we had the plan all laid out. It was really quite simple. It was one of those times that Annas and I were in complete agreement. He had part of the trial, I had part of the trial. We had arranged for the witnesses to tell just the right story, and we had it all wrapped up. There was just one small problem. As Jews, we didn't have the right to execute him. So we had to get Pilate in on the decision. Pilate was a bit of a wild card. We didn't know what he would do. But I knew this high priest how to turn some screws. I knew how to put some pressure on him to help him see things the way he should see them. But at first, I wasn't so sure. He tried to acquit Jesus. But with a little help from his friends, we persuaded him. And the coward just said that he washed his hands of the whole thing and turned Jesus over to us. And so, we had him crucified. I was surprised, quite honestly, how quickly he died. Crucifixion can sometimes take days. But when they nailed him to that cross, he was up there for a number of hours. But we already had a plan just in case. We wanted this over as quickly as possible. We wanted this ugly mess behind us. And so I had told Pilate, I said, tomorrow, tonight actually, at sundown, starts our Passover Sabbath. It's an important day for us, and we don't want these thieves on the crosses after sundown. You need to be sure, Pilate, that they are dead by sundown. So he instructed his soldiers to go around and break the legs of the people on the cross. You know why they do that, because when you're hanging on a cross, you don't really die from blood loss. You die from suffocation. You cannot breathe. You push up with your legs until your legs can no longer push up. And when they can no longer push up, you can no longer breathe. And when you can no longer breathe, you die. And by breaking their legs, we hasten the process. But when the soldiers came to Jesus, they discovered he was already dead. I suppose the soldiers had already beaten him half to death. So one of the centurions thrust a spear into his side for good measure. He was taken off of the cross and placed in another man's tomb. I thought that was it. We have rid ourselves of public enemy number one. Finally, I'm rid of these troublemakers. But I'd failed to take into account one little detail. Jesus rose from the dead. Now, to be sure, I didn't believe that. I refused to believe it. I mean, people don't rise from the dead. I already explained that to you. But that's what everyone said. His disciples, for example, when he was arrested in the garden, why, they all deserted him. And yet, not long after that, they marched into Jerusalem and they proclaimed boldly that they'd seen Jesus alive from the dead. And they continued to proclaim it to their very deaths. They believed it. I'm not so sure why, but I was determined to do all that I could to squelch this terrible rumor. So I had told Pilate, I said, Pilate, this man made a prediction that he would rise from the dead. I want you to put centurions outside of his tomb. I want you to make sure that Rome keeps him in his grave. And so Pilate put a seal on the stone and put soldiers outside. And there was no way that anyone was getting into or out of that tomb. We all knew it. So you can understand my disappointment when I heard from the soldiers, this crazy story about an earthquake and an angel, and that the tomb was empty. All I can tell you, I can't explain why, what happened or how it happened, but you know that resurrections are not possible. I don't know what everyone else was thinking. I just knew I was confused and I was frustrated. But you know the ironic thing? The thing that really made me wonder was when we decided that we should have Jesus crucified. We said, it is better that one person die than that the whole nation perish. But you know, less than half a century after I had Jesus crucified, under the Roman Emperor Tiberius, he came in and he ransacked the city and he destroyed the temple and he scattered our people. Despite my best efforts, the very thing I had sought to prevent came about. Another very ironic thing to me was while I had given the orders, while Jesus' execution was at my by my design, I've come to learn since that what I freely did and wanted to do was also the plan of God Himself. That He had planned this from ages long ago. And somehow what I did was used by Him to do something totally different. You see, it never occurred to me, never occurred to me, that Jesus could be anything other than a troublemaker. That He could be anything other than a pain in my rear flesh. But I realized, after all of this, to be honest, after life was over for me, that night before the trial, when I was with my children and we celebrated Passover, and we went through that ritual, why is tonight not like any other night? And I told them the story of the Passover lamb, the one who was slain so that our Jewish people could be liberated from the death angel who passed over them. It never occurred to me when I was trying Jesus and He stood there before me that there before me was the spotless Lamb of God. Never occurred to me, as the high priest, the one who was responsible for Yom Kippur and the celebrations that we had, where we would sacrifice a goat, and that one animal would be sacrificed for the sins of the whole people. Never did I think that I, as high priest, when I decreed that Jesus should be crucified, that I was authorizing the sacrifice of atonement for my people and for all people. How ironic, isn't it? I never saw it. Now, I've told you, it's not always as simple as it seems trying to decide who the good person and who the bad person is. I was so sure that I was the good person. Jesus had to be bad. I failed to realize something that I learned later, and that is that there is no such thing as good people and bad people. The line of good and bad runs straight through the heart of every one of us. It's there inside of you. It's there inside of me. One of the dangers, one of the great dangers of religion, doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Muslim, a Catholic, or even a Baptist, a danger of religion is that it is a mask. You put it on, and people see what's on the outside, and they sometimes believe what's on the outside. Sometimes you believe what's on the outside. But it's not that simple. It's like, how do you say it? Putting lipstick on a pig. It doesn't matter how well you decorate that pig. Deep inside, it still has the heart of a filthy swine. You think, because you're religious, that makes you good. So did I. I've discovered that the halls of heaven are full of self-righteous people who thought the same thing. But it doesn't work that way. That line that runs through my heart runs through your heart. It's important that we look from time to time to see what we are really like. No. I, Joseph Caiaphas, crucified Jesus. I must live with that for the rest of eternity. I know you've determined that I'm the villain in the story, but I tell you, it's not that simple. Take a look in your own heart, and you'll see that Jesus was there because of you as well. It was those wicked thoughts in your heart, those selfish actions that pounded the thorns into his head, the sins in your life that drove the nails into his hand. You are as guilty as I. But I'm here to tell you that Jesus, despite all of my intentions to rid the world of him, did not die as a victim. As I told you, I realized this wasn't just my plan, this was part of a bigger plan. Jesus died as a sacrifice, the atoning sacrifice, the sacrifice lamb. He died for those things in your heart, in your life, so that your heart and your hands can be clean. Do you believe that? Take a look at your heart. Just take a good look deep down inside. Do you see the heart of a pig? I tell you, I didn't. And because I refused to see myself and see my failures and see my need, I refused to embrace the one who could deliver me. But you can believe it. But then again, I don't really care what you believe. I just want to tell you that if anyone ever asks you, don't ever tell them that I failed to warn you.